Good morning to each one. May the grace and love of God be in each one of your hearts this morning. Ask you to continue praying for me. I think it started more Friday noon on. I've kind of felt not so well physically, so it's going to make this probably a bit harder for me. I appreciate your prayers, and hopefully God can still use me. Okay, to get started, I wanted to think of those two words just briefly. And starting off, so let's say we have a parent that is continually harping on their child. The child can, no matter what the child does, the parent says, oh, you could have done that better. No matter how much they want to please or try to please, they're never able to quite measure up. Which of those words would you say we would use for that? The ones I wrote up. If you can't see them, those are rejection and correction. Thank you. So now, what is correction? Somebody want to tell me what the difference is? I think we live in a world, and I'm not sure that the world hasn't been like that since the fall, that likes to confuse these two terms. Okay. So we could say, first of all, the motives would be different, right? Rejection is self-motivation on the part of the one giving it. While correction has love as a motive. Another thing that's different between these two is rejection is general.
Could correction be called rejection with direction?
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting thought. At the same time, I guess I look at the one as mainly negative, the other positive. At the same time, I'm not saying we can split hairs on words. I understand that. And so, yes, it's not that I'm trying to say you that would be a wrong way. As I want to look at it this morning, I want to speak about dealing with rejection. And so, therefore, I wanted to keep the focus on rejection as more in a negative light. So just if you look at the definition of rejection, it is to not experience love, acceptance, and belonging, to be shunned, pushed aside, forgotten, unwanted, unneeded, and not desired. So I'd like to have a question here. I wonder how many people here have ever felt rejected. If you've ever felt rejected, would you please stand up? I'm already standing, so I don't have to. Have you ever felt rejected? Okay, looks like the innocent children are mainly the ones that haven't. Okay, so stay standing, please. If you've felt rejected, let me see. Scared this would happen to me. So we have a lot of people who felt rejection. Now, in that rejection, did you enjoy it? If you did not, if you enjoy rejection, stay standing. If you didn't, sit down. I thought that might be a safe way of getting you all back down. Now, as I see it, there are two sources to the feelings that we have that lead to rejection, that feeling of rejection. The one is, and so these two sources are the rejection of a person as an individual. And this is a little bit, and I'm not trying to focus on parents necessarily, but if, per se, I, as a dad, I'm always picking on one of my daughters, and they never can do things right, it doesn't matter how hard they try, it's always wrong. That's rejection of a person. It's not really focused so much on what they do. It's all wrong. There is another one that can also feel like rejection, and that's why I wanted to clarify the difference between correction and rejection. The other is based in the lack of acceptance a sinner feels because he or she is unwilling to let go of sin. So the first is a legitimate struggle when you cannot please somebody at all. The other one is not, and the devil loves to put correction under the guise of rejection. And he does a pretty good job of that. And one place that's very evident is today in our culture would be, especially, probably most noticeable in relation to the homosexual movement. It's now no longer do you not only, how can I say this? Rejection is framed as condemnation of sin. And as such, if you stand with truth, if you stand for truth, you're considered a rejecter, somebody who rejects, and therefore you're demonized. And that's actually an incorrect view of this. But I wanted to look at a few things. I'm going to mainly focus on rejection. Remember, there's self-motivation in the person giving rejection. And it's also general in focus. It's not saying there's specific needs in your life. It's saying you're all bad. So as you look at that, to help us understand this, I think one thing that helps me is to look at what I call rejectors. Now, interestingly enough, in a shotgun, those of you that fool with shotguns, they have ejectors. You know what that is? Actually, most guns do, right? That's when you open it up or when you shoot, it ejects the empty shell. Well, now in a shotgun, the ejector and the shell are two different things. Now, when we're talking about rejection, interestingly enough, very often the rejected and the rejectors can be the same person. I want you to think about that for a minute, and we'll come back to that more later. Okay, so rejectors are those who reject and put down others, a person unaccepting of others. So a rejector minimizes other people and inflicts pain on others in an ineffective effort to lift him or herself up and to help themselves feel better about themselves. They are fearful that others may get or have that which they would like to have but evades them. And so it kind of goes like this. I feel bad. I don't feel good about myself. So I'm going to try to make sure everybody around me feels bad about themselves as well. And I'm going to really lay it on to rejectors, but they're inherently small-souled, proud, and perennially insecure people. I'd like for you to think about that one, who try to cover their own hurts and feelings of inadequacy by pointing out and dwelling on the supposed faults and failures of others. That's a rejector. Now, I have a story I'd like to talk about. It's in Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, verse 3 through 14. I don't know if I'll just read this story. I might tell it to you. So we have got two brothers, two offerings, two motives, and two attitudes. Anyone of the children tell me who two brothers in Genesis 4 are? Does anybody know? The two brothers in Genesis chapter 4. You know Russell? I'll make it easy for y'all. Cain is one. Who was Cain's brother, first brother? Anybody know? Abel. Good job, Abel. Thank you. Cain and Abel. So we have the two brothers, and these two brothers both went, in our way of talking, went to church. They went to worship. And they both brought something with them to give to God. Kind of fits with what Brian read this morning. Now, the one, it says, God accepted. He had respect to it. The other one says he did not accept it, or he did not have respect to it. And as I thought about that, there in verse 3, we have Cain's offering. There's a couple things wrong with Cain's offering. The first one is kind of indirect, but we can follow it. It's an offering of the fruit of the ground. If you go back to, I'm sorry, we're in chapter 4. If we go back to chapter 3, verse 21, God had already set precedence for spilling blood, innocent blood for sin. And I think Cain knew that. Furthermore, Cain, if you look at verse 3 in chapter 4, Genesis chapter 4, it says that in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. So Cain simply brought an offering. It was just the general thing he had. Nothing special, nothing extraordinary, just whatever he first came to, I take it. Whereas Abel, it especially specifies in verse 4 that Abel brought of the firstlings, that means the best of his flock, and of the fat, or the nicer ones. So Cain had two things against him before he ever started. He didn't bring a blood offering. He didn't bring the best. Then I think there was something else, and Brian touched on it this morning. I think, like I said, there was two attitudes, right? Cain came with, I don't know, I think he had selfish motives. I don't know why Cain went to church that morning or went to worship. But I think he did it as a way to manipulate God. Whereas Abel came to simply give something to God for who God was. So Abel, like I mentioned already, brought an offering. He brought the proper type. He brought an exceptional one, the firstling and of the fat thereof. Well, we got a problem in verse 5. We got an angry man. We have God, it says, but unto Cain and to his offering, he, talking of God, had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. So Cain, as a rejecter, was an angry person. And he did exactly what many people today do today. He took correction, the correction that God brought to his life to tell him that he needed to change. He turned around and took it as rejection. You know, they construe judgment on disobedience as rejection. They are unwilling to admit to themselves that they are personally accountable for problems in their life. Because they lack this honesty, they go about directing their frustration and enmity at anyone and everyone who crosses their path, and especially at those who make them feel threatened, which coincidentally often is the ones who are seeking to live in obedience to God. We can find that down in verse 8. Verse 8, we have Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. So now Cain took correction as rejection. He turned around and rejected his brother. Then he did a few other things. Another thing a rejecter does is they live in denial about their actions and the effect of their actions on others. Verse 9, and the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel that brother? And he says, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? So he only does not take responsibility for himself, but he's also excuses himself for murdering Abel. And their thought process runs something like this is, you know, I wasn't accepted. My offering wasn't accepted. I don't feel like changing it. So rather than changing it and repenting, I will kill Abel. And it's Abel's own fault because after all, Abel made me mad. Abel was respected. I wasn't. So they're unwilling to take responsibility for themselves and consider ones they harm as guilty for provoking them. The next thing they do is they're totally self-focused. Let's read verse 13. And Cain said unto the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Here you have a man who just killed his brother and denied any knowledge of it. Yet he now complains, even though grace is extended to him, saying, oh, in reality, he should have been killed for his brother's blood. But when he's told that he has to live separate from other people for the rest of life, he says, oh, it's greater than I can bear. Totally self-focused. He now complains, even though grace has been extended way beyond what he deserves. Then in verse 14, excuse me, he begins to worry about having the same fate inflicted on himself, which it should have been, in contrast to the totally innocent brother he just murdered. So now in verse 14, we have Cain worrying about getting murdered. He says, oh, you know what? If you send me out there and somebody sees me, they're going to kill me. Well, should he care? After all, he'd just done that. What was the big deal about getting killed, right? Self-focused. Now there's another person. I won't really bother reading all these verses. Well, it would just take way too long. But it starts at 1 Samuel 19. We have Saul, as he gets later moving on in his life. We have King Saul, the ruler of a nation, becoming totally infatuated with chasing around a nobody in a desert, a shepherd boy, because he felt threatened. Now remember, rejectors are self-focused and self-absorbed persons trying to make themselves feel and look good in any way possible. When a person of this caliber, in other words, Saul, when Saul rejected David and pursued him in this way, you know, one thing David had to remember is that it wasn't nearly so much about who David was as it was about who Saul was and the emptiness Saul saw within himself. And so if you ever felt rejected, take time to realize that often when you experience rejection from someone else, it's generally because of a problem in that person's heart and life. And interestingly enough, as I was thinking about this, in my experience, the two groups of people most apt to reject others are the Cains. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Which the Cains are those who are rejecting truth. You know, that thing with Abel, while he took it out on Abel, Abel just became the face of Cain's problem. In reality, Cain had a much bigger problem than Abel. So we have those who are rejecting truth will reject others. They can't help it. They become angry. And rather than becoming obedient and finding God's grace to forgive and move on in obedience, they become angry and they separate themselves from God, which in turn causes them to reject others. That's the one group. Now, the second group is the one I'm probably more concerned about. And this is those who see themselves as protecting truth. And I think Saul kind of fits in this category, if I may say so. Saul became obsessed with protecting his position. You know, there was a couple times that David had the opportunity to kill Saul, and he said he wouldn't lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. And you know, I think Saul really liked that philosophy because that was him. And while I didn't live in Saul's mind, I really wonder if Saul didn't get to the place where he was obsessed with protecting his position, with his place in the world, and the way he twisted this around was, after all, God, I was anointed to this position, therefore I have to defend it against all comers. Now, I want to be clear. While we may never minimize or excuse sin, as a Christian today, ours is a ministry of reconciliation, not one of rejection and condemnation. And I've seen many, I'm going to say well-meaning people, because I think some of them are, who are willing to severely strain relationships and damage others in their relationships in an effort to do what they think is protecting truth. And I'm afraid I've been guilty of doing this myself. But it's almost like truth becomes some sort of Dagon that we have to prop up by our own effort. You know, and a person who does this, who relates to truth in that way, is simply showing their own insecurity in truth, in what they claim to believe. I was trying to think of a good illustration of this. And probably one good area for this, where this works out for me, is in name brand stuff. And I'm sorry, ladies, I'm not going to get into your name brands, but I can use some that affect me. So in my work, I use a lot of Makita Partles. And it's not necessarily that I think there's no other good ones out there. I've tried a number of others. But I am satisfied, I guess you would say, content in the knowledge that a Makita Partle for what I'm doing works about as well as anything I've tried. Now, if I'm insecure in that knowledge, every time somebody comes around that's saying, oh, you should use a Milwaukee, or you should use, Hilti. You should use a Hilti or something. You know what's going to happen? Is I'm going to feel threatened. I'm going to have to go to great lengths to say why I use Makita, right? I'm going to have to say, oh, I tried the Milwaukee, which I actually did, and we burnt them up in the first 3 days, which actually happened. But in other words, I get all defensive and I have to give a huge explanation as to why I use Makita. Now, if I'm secure in the knowledge of that Makita does the job I want and they work fine for us for the most part, then I don't have to go through that explanation, right? Because I'm secure in the knowledge that I have. And this is what I see many Christians not doing, is they seem to be insecure in the knowledge of who Christ is in them. And so what they end up doing is they end up having to run circles and become very defensive when people question them, their beliefs, or their application. And it really comes from an insecurity in their own heart and life. And this in turn leads them to reject or push away those who ask the question. And remember, when we do that, I'm simply showing my own insecurity. While I, as an individual, must always stand with truth. I want to be understood. As a Christian, I need to point all people towards the truth. As congregations, we need to help each other build our lives on the truth. This in no way gives me a license or a pass to reject others. Rather, to the contrary, a Christian will be the most accepting of all people. As a Christian, those whom God brings into my life should never experience rejection from me. Because I am free, I'm secure in my knowledge to love and to reach out to all those I associate with in truth. Security in the truth sets me free from the need to reject or push away others. I can be and should be secure in the knowledge of who I am, of what I am, and what I stand for in Christ. Now, I think maybe you think, wow, he's getting off the deep end on that. Well, just wait a minute. That's the one side of the coin. On the other hand, as a Christian, I will experience rejection from those who reject truth. They will not appreciate the truth I represent and live for and by. In this, they will likely accuse me of rejection. That will happen. But this should not be true. God's correction of sin is only rejection of a person when that person rejects God and chooses sin. Just so I, as a Christian, should not be rejecting others, but they may reject me because of the truth living in me. And so sometimes a separation does occur, but I think it's very important that we as a Christian do not cause that separation, except for by standing for truth and with truth. But it's not like I have to prop up truth or cut you off because you are wrong. And a few further questions on this is, how many people has rejection won for Christ? Think about that. How many people has rejection won for Christ? Bring it a little closer. How many of you are Christians today because someone showed you love? Or are you a Christian today because someone rejected you? How can I reject and assign perdition on anyone for whom Christ has died? And also, who will a struggling person turn to? To the one who has rejected them? Or to the one who stands with truth and in that security reaches out in love to those around them? And I guess there's something especially comes to my mind when I think of this. I have a number of cousins, especially in the one family, who are not following the truth they know. And that's evident by the way they live. At the same time, they would still show up at our family gatherings and things occasionally. I had another uncle who I really feel was one of these people that he meant well. At the same time, he thought he had to prop up truth. In other words, I really feel he felt insecure in the truth that he knew. Because whenever my cousins were around that weren't living the way they should have been, he would have to walk up to them as a group and say, "Oh, the judgment of the Lord is coming," and statements like that. And you could just see them block it out. They would just tune out completely on him. But you know what would have meant a whole lot more is if he would have been secure in the knowledge he possessed about God and in what God really wanted for these young men, and could have in that taken an interest in them. And rather than pronouncing God's judgment on them, is show them how a Christian ought to live. Okay, and that brings me to the next point, the rejected. Now realize, when I'm talking about the rejected, I'm not talking about those who need correction. There is times that correction seems very close to rejection. But it's not. Rejection is, like we said, it's general, it's all bad. So in thinking about the rejected ones, we're again thinking about those who are not accepted, the pushed aside, forgotten, unwanted, unneeded, despised, minimized, used, and discarded, almost like trash. Now, evidently, you all have felt like that on occasion. I know I have. And if you're still feeling this way about yourself this morning, I guess I'd tell you this, my heart goes out to anyone who feels that way. I know how it feels, to a degree. Our experiences have all been different. And in a natural way, I would say I wish nobody would have to experience feeling that way about themselves. So what I share next is not done to add to your rejection, if that's what you're facing, but it's my desire and prayer to love and bless those that God brings into my life. And so what I share next is to help us understand ourselves when we struggle with rejection. And also for those, maybe you don't face it so much yourself, but you will likely meet somebody who does struggle with this. And I want to assure everyone that God loves and has the answers for our struggles when it comes to rejection. Why don't we open our Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. And if you feel rejected this morning, I'd like for you to think about one thing as well while we look at Elijah. Elijah experienced a lot of rejection. But even Elijah in his circumstance had this problem. And this is what the problem is. The more you expect to be rejected, the more supposed rejection you will find. The more rejection you think you find, the more you look for it, suppose it, and invent it. So keep that in mind. That's what Elijah did, and I would propose to you that we're not that different from Elijah. Okay, so we have Israel at one of the lowest times ever. We have a king who married a wife who brought in about the worst kind of idol worship you could have. We have a prophet of God who, in an effort to correct the things in Israel, pronounces that there will be a drought, a famine, basically. And so now we, in the beginning of chapter 18, we have a king and one of his trusted servants, who, by the way, is serving God, interestingly enough, going out to find water so that their animals don't all die. And so we have God telling this prophet, Elijah, to go to the king, to show himself to this wicked king, because he is now ready to break this drought, this famine. So God tells Elijah, go talk with Ahab, go show yourself to him. And so we have Ahab and Obadiah out there trying to find water. They split up and were trying to find water for their animals. And Elijah comes to Obadiah. And they have their conversation in verses 7 through 15. And then Obadiah, as a good servant does, after being reassured that this Elijah, this prophet, won't evaporate in thin air while he's gone, goes and gets Ahab. And so we have Ahab coming, and Ahab is a rejecter. He comes up and he sees Elijah and he says, aha, here's the guy that's been troubling Israel. Now Elijah actually had that straight. He's like, no, he said, you are the one who's troubled Israel. At the same time, Elijah was a bit discouraged, and he actually, I think, left that go fairly deep. But he calls this meeting at Mount Carmel. And in chapter 18, verse 21, we have a huge group of people, all Israel, gathered there at Mount Carmel with these 450 prophets. And Elijah, it says, came unto the people and said, how long halt ye between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. But if it be Baal, follow him. Have you ever thought about that? Here's a whole country, or at least most of the country, together. And it says, the people answered him not a word. That was a quiet service. I guess everybody was just quiet. So Elijah says, who are you going to follow? Then in verse 22, we have a glimpse of how Elijah felt about this. He goes on and tells the people, then said Elijah unto the people, I, even I only, remain a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Well, that was actually not true, and Elijah knew it wasn't true. If you would go back to verse, verse 13, Obadiah had just told Elijah a couple days before this, whenever it was, that he had hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50 in caves. So I don't know. I think Elijah actually started this. It's interesting how God was working through somebody that was actually really struggling at this point. So Elijah's saying that I only am left, even though he's been told specifically that there's at least 101 people who are still trying to do the right thing. But he moves on. God works through Elijah, and he had a wonderful day, we could say. I don't know how many of you have called down fire from heaven that burnt up rocks and everything else, but Elijah did. So he had a pretty good day by natural appearance. Well, then that brings us into chapter 19, where Jezebel finds out how Elijah was the cause of being all her prophets killed. And so Ahab tells Jezebel what happened. Evidently, she wasn't there. And all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain the prophets with the sword. And then verse 2, then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life, as the life of one of them, the prophets, by tomorrow about this time. Have you ever wondered, Elijah's thoughts should have run, should they not have? You know, what can Jezebel do to me? After all, what can a wicked woman, wicked vengeful queen even, do against a God that burns up rocks, dust, and water? That's not what Elijah thought, though. No, unfortunately not. He did probably what most of us would have done. He looked around. He still had this thought that I only am left. So he felt alone, uncared for, rejected. He saw himself as misunderstood. And even after his wonderful day, he's still alone. He feels alone. Even after God answered his prayer, even after the rain came. So he gathers his robe about him and he runs for his life. Verse 3. It says he went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. So he actually crossed over into Mexico, if you will. Went to a different country. But even that isn't far enough. Somehow he's scared he's going to be extradited or something. So he lets his servant there. And he keeps going for another day out into the wilderness. Really hard to find now. And then he sits down underneath a tree and gives way to self-pity. He says, I've had enough of this. And he tells God, just take my life. Now, what kind of sense does this make to you? Jezebel was just offering to take his life, right? And he ran for all he was worth to get out of there. And now he's there saying, take my life. That is the very reason he'd been running a few hours earlier, was to save his life. Well, God doesn't actually correct him at this point. We have one amazing meal in verse 5 through 9. I don't know how many of you cooks have tried to cook a meal that can last somebody for 40 days. But it tells us that Elijah went in the strength of the meal that he ate there underneath that tree for 40 days. So I don't know what kind of steak he had, but it must have really stuck to him, huh? But he keeps going. And so Elijah keeps going. And finally he finds himself at this cave. And then God asks Elijah a question. He says, what are you doing here? So Elijah tells God all about it. He did the right thing. He tells God all about this. And he again makes this false, preposterous claim. Behold, I only am left. Like I pointed out already, he knew this was not true. Obadiah had told him that he personally had saved 100 men. And I don't know, I would have considered Obadiah another faithful man. So you had 101. In verse 13, God asks Elijah again. He says, you know, chapter 19, verse 13. God talks to Elijah again. He says, what do you do here, Elijah? He gives him a chance to correct his wrong statement. But yet, Elijah just repeated it in verse 14. He says, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the swords. And I only am left. And they seek my life to take it away. So what's interesting to me is God did not necessarily directly contradict Elijah's false, whatever you want to call it. But he gave him some work to do. Verse 15 through 18, he tells him to go and anoint Hazael king over Syria, to anoint Jehu king over Israel. And then he gives him a very interesting job. He says, and Elisha, son of Shaphat, the last part of verse 18, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room? So God indirectly tells him, now wait a minute here, Elijah. You are not the only one left. In fact, I have a person that you is so faithful that I want him to anoint. You anoint him to take over your work. And then in verse 18, he kind of puts the final nail in this thing and says, tells Elisha, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. So he ends his thing by telling Elijah, you're wrong by 7,000. Now, I'd like to take a few lessons from the life of Elijah. Is in what a rejected person does. If you're struggling with this and you allow this to control you, this is what you'll do. Excuse me. You'll respond in fear. You will run from pressure. You will pity yourself. You will exaggerate the problem. You will question God's providence. You will become oversensitive. You lose perspective. You withdraw from others. You become angry at God. You become hopelessly apathetic. That means basically lazy. You sit down underneath the tree. You become a victim of despair. You become depressed and actually entertain suicidal thoughts. You wish you could die. Now, it's interesting as I think about that. You know, there are a few main things that lead people to feel rejected. Maybe number one that I'll mention is because it starts with us as young parents so often is, if I'm going through my life feeling rejected and I'm operating as a rejected person, I can almost guarantee you, I will raise children who feel rejected as well. Another one I struggle with is parents who never affirm or commend their children produce children who feel rejected. And that one's kind of hit me between the eyes pretty often, is to make sure I give commendation. Because if I'm always correcting, correction is necessary, don't get me wrong. But if it's always correction, no commendation, that leads to feelings of rejection. It's also parents who break the spirit rather than the will of their child. And I want to be clear here. It's very important that our children have broken wills. At the same time, that doesn't mean that I beat the spirit out of them or anything like that. The fourth one is those who struggle with trying to meet high expectations of others. And I think this can be a big problem in our circles, if that's not tempered by love. High expectations aren't necessarily wrong, but they have to be tempered by love. And if we're just offering to reject people, it won't work. Along with that is those who have anger directed at them. And then the last two are very closely, but it's those who have unconfessed sin in their life. If I have sin in my life, I will find rejection everywhere. And along with that, then it's those unwilling to fully surrender to God. They will also find rejection everywhere. Okay, what happens if I allow these feelings of rejection to control me? Well, number one, I'll feel like I am the problem. To a degree anyways, I will operate as if I'm the problem. This leads me to become frustrated, which in turn leads to bitterness and anger. So I become increasingly discouraged and depressed, and frankly, I lose hope. Now I become anxious and worry about the good friendships and relationships I have, and I fear they will be lost. Well, let me tell you, that's about the worst way to maintain good friendships, is to worry about losing them. It's actually just being yourself. The next thing is we withdraw and stop communicating openly for fear of being misunderstood, which in turn leads us to pull away from the love others would extend to us. Now we are rejecting, see? It goes from being rejected to the rejecter. Then we lock our heart, we hide it. We're no longer open. We no longer are there to be loved. We resist love. The last step in that is we no longer focus on or care about the needs and desires of others. It's all about me. It's all about me and my problems. If I continue down this path, it leads to I won't talk, I can't trust, I put on false fronts and personalities. Wish I didn't know about that. I will pretend to be okay when I most definitely am not. Inside of me, like I said, is one big hurt. It's about my pain, my issues, my problems are all messed up together, and I call that self-focus. And I will often use a facade, false front. It's my fault. I'm not worth much. Don't bother with me, or I'm just weird. Have you ever heard anybody say that? That's a red flag for somebody who's actually doing this process. I will have negative thoughts about myself and others. I will try to find love and acceptance through performance and by trying to excel or attract attention to self through natural gifts and talents. And in this way, moral failure often lies at the root. A lot of moral failure, let's say it that way, lies some shape of unresolved rejection. I will have feelings of self-pity. Feelings that no one cares or understands, comprehends, or loves me. Now, the other thing is I look for rejection. I use the experiences in the past of rejection to rate current friendships and relationships. I imagine that others look down on me and are critical of me. When I do not experience what I expect to experience, I become suspicious. Let me give you an illustration of this. Is this generally happens in things that you are sensitive in. And I've seen this come out in different ways, and I'll just talk about one that I used to struggle with, was my height. I think I'm over that one. But so let's say I am sensitive about my height or my weight. Actually, that's another good one. And I've seen one, I don't want anybody to feel bad this morning. I've seen people do it on skin color too, which is equal. Yeah, it's all the same. But you become super sensitive about anything anybody says in relation to height, weight, or skin color. And you interpret everything they say as a negative about yourself in that area. And so now, maybe one, I'll just use one illustration. I've seen somebody send an email around that they meant to be humorous in relation to one of those. And somebody else that was very sensitive in that area, they actually sent it to them. And this person responded in just almost bitterness, like, they're just mocking me. They're mocking me how God made me in this area. And it was really so stupid. Because quite frankly, the whole reason that email had been sent to them was because of humor. And I'm pretty sure the person that sent them to it, sent this email, was such a good friend of this person that they never even thought of how they would take it. You follow me? But because this person was looking for rejection, they found it, where it was absolutely not intended. So I look for rejection. Another thing we do is I will block love because of fear and suspicion about the motives and intents of others. Another one is I will feel useless and unworthy of love and attention. And when somebody does try to love me, I push them away because love makes me vulnerable and potentially hurts. I don't know what to do with it. That brings me back to something I read earlier. The more you expect to be rejected, the more supposed rejection you will find. Remember that. Rejection is not logical. Once you start looking for it, you will find it everywhere. In the emails, in the texts, in your friendships, in lighthearted conversation, you can find it and manufacture a lot. The more rejection you think you find, the more you look for it and suppose it and invent it. I don't know, there's no way to scientifically put a percentage on this. But I would say in my life experience, my personal experience, probably somewhere between 50 to 75% of the rejection I personally have experienced was either imagined or at least added to by my own looking for it. Am I making sense? Generally, we look for something, you'll find it, and even when it's not meant. So that brings me not to just let this lay now. What is the solution to rejection? A lot of you say you've experienced it. Maybe I should let you tell me what the solution is. I'll tell you what the solution has been for me. And it's kind of one of those paradoxes in life. The solution to rejection is the one who has been rejected probably more than any of us. We could turn to Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3. It says, he was despised and rejected of men. So we have Christ who comes into the earth as a child. Now think about this for a minute. Which of you, we have a number here that are expecting additions to their family or their home. If you had to have that baby in a barn, how many of you wouldn't feel just a tad bit rejected? I've got a feeling most of us wouldn't be too pleased with that arrangement. But that's where Christ was born, to start with. It didn't stop there. Not only was he rejected, he was rejected to the extent that the ruler, the king at that point, killed, we don't know, hundreds, thousands of children, two and under, to try to rid the world of him before he was ever really growing, just a baby. We have them living in Egypt, outcasts, immigrants, for 12 years. Or is it 7 years? I'm sorry. Then even after they come back, This seems like there was a relative time there where there wasn't much going on after the temple thing to his ministry. But in his ministry, yes, there was a certain amount of acceptance from the common people in some ways, but not in the way he was looking for. They wanted to make him an earthly king rather than have him ruling in their hearts. And then finally, we know, we just went through that some last Sunday, how he was sent to the cross, denied by his disciples, crucified and died. And if I understand the gospel story correctly, and in Isaiah 53, not only was Christ rejected by the people that crucified him, but he experiences rejection from me today. When I say his power isn't sufficient for me, when I'm unwilling to yield my life to him, he still experiences rejection from me. Yet he is the one who experienced, shall we say, ultimate rejection, is the solution to my feelings of rejection. And I have 5 steps, if you struggle with rejection, that you need to implement. The first is to allow another to love you. And I'm thinking of a Christian kind of love, a love for who you are, not your performance or whatever. The second one is see Christ as the answer, the only source of value. You know, today you can add up this list of whatever you think are your good character is, your good talents, whatever you think you are, but Paul tells us there that there's absolutely trash in the sight of God. The only value any of us can claim this morning is the value that Christ has given us, and that's a high value. He valued us as much as his life. Our third one is ask God to heal you, to restore you. And that means brokenness. The fourth one, root out bitterness caused by rejection by confession and forgiveness. And then the fifth is cultivate God's gift of love that allows you to love and accept others. So let's say you have a big, shall we say, rejection pain in your life. Remember, a rejection pain confessed is a rejection pain shared. A rejection pain shared with God is a rejection pain being healed. A rejection pain being healed by God is a rejection pain replaced by the love of God. You know, the one who experienced ultimate rejection is the solution to my struggle with rejection. And maybe just a few thoughts is, I think sometimes we really fail to see the symptoms. Sometimes we see people that are sick. I don't know what you think. The reason I had to drink so much water and talk like I did this morning is a sore throat. And so we may be pretty good at diagnosing some of those things. But when it comes to spiritual things, sometimes we do a pretty shabby job. So just a few things. If God should ever lead you into the path, one is to experience rejection. Remember a couple things. Number one is pray with them, and if they let you, pray for them, and if they let you, pray with them. The second is lead them to Christ and to see his rejection as the answer to their rejection. And the third one is, oftentimes people that have experienced rejection will actually make it difficult to be loved. They will actually try to push you away. They'll try to tell you all the bad things they've done and all that. But never, never give up or drop them. If that relationship is severed, let it be done on their part. And make sure you love and value them as a person for whom Christ has died, because finally, that's the only value I have. And remember, for all of us, Christ is and has the answer for all that we face. Let's kneel for prayer.